thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Thank you, Kim.
Here's John Williams.
I got some big thoughts today. One of them is a refined version of yesterday's thought. I thought it was really a good thought, and then I was told otherwise. I'm going to work it again today. Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, will join us today. I haven't talked to him in a while. We will on stage soon. I want you there. Yeah, we'll tell you about tickets, and we'll check in with TJ, as I like to call him. We have two shows coming up. We almost always do them now at the College of DuPage. It's centrally located. It's a great venue. They got really nice people out there. No reason not to do anything with the good folks at the College of DuPage, but we like to spread the love around. So our traveling series of shows I do with various presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, Thomas Jefferson, Meriwether Lewis, of course, the great explorer, will now head a little north. We will be in Elgin at Elgin Community College. The theater there is called the Blizzard Theater, as opposed to the Mackinich Center for Performing Arts. We'll be at the Blizzard in Elgin, and we're going to be up there December 2nd. And as always, I'll take the stage with Thomas Jefferson, and we'll talk for 30, 40 minutes, and then for 30 or 45 minutes, you get a chance to ask questions, too. I'll ask him, what does he make of statues in his honor, or anybody else's? I'll ask him, what does he think about calling fallen families? I'm not exactly sure what we're going to talk about. It's old stuff, it's new stuff, and you get to ask questions, too. I'll ask him about wine, maybe apple pie. I'm not sure. That's the joy of these conversations. They're always true to Jefferson. You will hear more verbatim Jefferson quoted than maybe people heard in Jefferson's day. I'm not kidding. Jefferson wrote thousands of letters. He didn't memorize them. Our Jefferson did. So when he's speaking about what our founding fathers thought, said, or did, you're literally getting it from the horse's mouth, except the horse has been dead for a while. So that'll be one show, and then we do another show a short while later. That is, we'll do a morning show and an early afternoon show, and Meriwether Lewis will come to the stage, and Meriwether Lewis and I will talk about maybe the single greatest American exploration story ever, the greatest adventure story in American history, period. And we'll tell that in the first person, and that's a spectacular fun. Again, funny show, the way we present it. And you'll get a chance to ask questions as well. All of the details at WGNradio.com/events. Just a quick note here. Two magazine covers. The one dated October 16th in The New Yorker has only the black outlines of cartoon bullets, just little black bullets scattered all across the cover, and then a name on each one of the bullets, a bullet for every person that was killed in the Nevada and the Las Vegas shooting. It's really powerful that way. It personalizes them. You see the bullets. It's very thought-provoking. The cover of Time magazine this week just arrived on my doorstep today. And boy, there was Harvey Weinstein living the life. Life was good for Harvey. He made money. He flirted with successful people. He traveled in elite circles. He was a serial predator, and he was getting away with it. Until one day, the New York Times said, you know what? It stops today. And all of a sudden, everybody noticed the elephant in the room. So there's what they do, you know, when they have a bad guy. They did this to OJ. You make a grainy black and white photo of them that shows every sad-shaped freckle on your face. So there he is, close-up, black background, black and white photo of him, kind of looking askance. He's looking at you sideways. And he just looks terrible. He literally looks like a bear. He's got an unshaven face, as is his wont. He must think that's a good look. Harvey, it's not working. And his collar's unbuttoned, and he looks positively menacing. And the cover simply says, Producer, Predator, Pariah. And that's the cover of Time. If you don't read it, you'll know a lot about that story right there. And in fact, Heidi Stevens wrote about it in the Chicago Tribune. She referenced a piece that was in the New York Times recently where one of the women that's a star on The Big Bang Theory said, you know, ladies, and then she made her point about feminism these days and about being sexy and flirtatious in Hollywood. And so she made that point, and then Heidi and everybody else has another point. We'll talk about the two sides of that coin after 1:30 here on WGN. Steve, You know, I posted on my Facebook page, or when was it? Mid-July.
Yeah.
We were halfway through President Trump's first year in office, right? January, February, March, April, May, June, July. So when we got to the halfway point, we posted the President Trump cuckoo brackets, things that made you scratch your head. You couldn't believe that happened, but there it was. And there were so many of those moments in the first 6 months, and we were getting accustomed to his behavior that, you know, we started to write them down. You know, you had things like like when he said John McCain wasn't a good enough hero, or when he gave that speech to the Boy Scouts, or when he invited the women that he said President Clinton assaulted to one of the town hall meetings or debates with Hillary. And you just couldn't believe it. It was one stunt or act after another. So we did a 20-team bracket, and as you may recall, the final four were his weird handshakes. I was going to say Covfefe, but no, it wasn't Covfefe. What was it? It was the final four were Clinton women at the debate, the Montenegro shove. Remember when the Prime Minister of Montenegro was at that summit? The G7 or G14 or whatever it was, 14, 15, whatever it takes.
Gee, get out of my way.
That's what it was. And he realized that he wasn't front and center, so he just shoves that guy out of the way like he's a stagehand and stepped in front of the Prime Minister from Montenegro. That made it to the final four. It so bespoke Trump's vision of himself and his behavior. The other two in the final four, and the Sean Spicer first press conference about the crowd size did not make the final four, and yet I had that one winning it all. The other two in the final four were the Boy Scout Jamboree speech, easily one of the nuttiest public pronouncements by presidents ever, and McCain is not a hero.
As so I remember, it was a fluid bracket, right? Because
things, well, that was the problem. Every time it was like putting a book on the shelf and then the one on the other end keeps falling off. We finally cut it off in July at 20 because we were never finishing the bracket. Every day something else would trump something else. So we came up with that 20 teams. You all voted. And you said that, what was the winner then, Elif? So the nuttiest moment in the first 6 months of Trump's presidency was the Boy Scout speech,
BSA
wasn't it?
Speech, yep.
The BSA speech. Hard to argue with that, except all the others deserve some credit too now, don't they? So we said, okay, in 6 months we'll do it again. And we're about halfway through the next 6 months. So I've just been working on it. In fact, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm WGN King John on Twitter. WGN King John on Twitter. We just posted a picture of me in front of the Trump 1.2 brackets. And so here's what you've had since then. I mean, the first 6 months, it was just whiplash, right? Not that it's changed necessarily, but you're sort of used to it now. But if you say, okay, the first 6 months, go to the end of July, what's happened since then? Here's what we have. The mooch, the whole Scaramucci story, that whole two-week arc came and went. The mooch is an entity unto itself in the brackets. The police speech, where he said you don't have to be nice to suspects. The fire and fury speech, we'll rain fire and fury on North Korea like the world has never seen. That had people scratching their heads. The many Charlottesville happened and his inability to handle that. Remember the many sides, bad people on both sides. The UN speech where he called Kim Jong-un Rocket Man. The mayor, the fight he picked with the San Juan mayor after the hurricane went through there, that whole episode. So we just put San Juan mayor fight, the moron, not a moron episode, and now Obama didn't make calls to the Gold Star families. All of that to get to this point about that. It's just another line in the brackets. So yesterday, when I was suggesting that however fascinating or depressing or important this is, we need to sort of keep some sort of perspective about it. We haven't learned anything about President Trump in the last week that we didn't know before. In fact, I have 28 other examples that are akin to this. So, yeah, let's talk about it. Yeah, let's beat him up because that feels good. But I'm not sure that resolving what the president meant, or is he a liar, or is he insensitive, or does he lack empathy? I'm not sure that, you know, resolving this debate or trying to win this argument is doing anybody any good. Your witness. don't have anything to say about that.
I'm sorry, John. I was distracted.
It's okay. It was really good, too.
I'm sure it was. You were talking about the...
You really were working in the newsroom.
I was doing things at once.
That's okay. No. Don't try and fix it. Do this. It's 1:20. I have to pause anyway. My number's 312-981-7200. So I'm just interested in your feedback on this. I mean, I'm going to talk a little bit more about it. In fact, I want to play another piece of audio for you today. But do you agree with me that while this is just reprehensible, it's the latest team in the reprehensible tournament? And we really would be better off not focusing so much energy on this as trying to figure out what that bipartisan health care bill is about. And yet on the morning news, it's dominating that. Every time they get a chance to ask the president, they're still asking him about it. Way too much energy is being spent on, did the president act appropriately after those soldiers died in Niger? Or was he, you know, as empathetic as the Bushes and Clintons and Obamas and so forth? That's just sort of my cautionary observation for the week. It's 1:21. Still to come, we'll visit with Thomas Jefferson, third president of these United States. Heidi Stevens is in our studio, the Tribune columnist. Oh, and Joel Stein, the darty, funny, and friendly Joel Stein from Time Magazine, the essayist who writes their almost weekly awesome column, will join us in the 2 o'clock hour. His piece the other day about leadership was, once again, laugh out loud funny. So he'll talk to us a little bit about leadership. Maybe he can tell us what the Cubs need to do to win. How depressing was that last night? It's just not fun watching the NLCS, even when your team is in it.
It's really not fun. Maybe, I mean, we shouldn't be saying this because we waited so long and here it is the third year in a row.
We're so spoiled, right?
I was thinking that, like, we're like Braves fans now. We're in the 90s.
Oh, we are so not Braves fans. Really? Braves fans don't even go to playoff games. Remember that? You'd see the Braves because every year they were in the, at least the NLDS and sometimes the CS, and you'd see empty seats and you go, how is that possible? I'll tell you what, last night at that game, that crowd was into it. They were there for the Cubs. Lordy, they were rooting them on. They cared about every pitch. And it was a bad game. It's just like we're not hitting. Our pitching is okay. We're making ridiculous plays. There were moments last night. I thought, what's going on here? I thought, well, it wasn't John. Ian Happ. When Ian Happ caught that ball, center field, banged into the wall, and the ball popped out, I thought that was a catch. Especially in slow motion because he had it longer, but I thought that looked like an actual catch. I posted on my Twitter account a picture of Daisy, my dappled dachshund, reacting to Carl Edwards walking Hugh Darvish. By the way, after Darvish, their pitcher gets a walk-off, not a walk-off, but a bases-loaded walk to score a run. How embarrassing is that? He did a bat flip? He did a bat flip. I didn't notice that until this morning.
You mean after the walk?
Yeah. He just kind of flips his bat, like, take that, Chicago, and strolls. I'm not one for beaning people, but somebody needs to go down tonight. And not that we can afford to give up more base runners, but good grief. In our house, we have, like, no respect. We have nothing. We're still, we are striking out a lot, a lot. So hopefully they'll turn the tide and win the next four games starting tonight. Hopefully that'll all happen starting this evening. Pick up a couple of phone calls here. John, you're on WGN Radio. We were talking about Trump and his calling the Gold Star families. What did you want to say?
Well, I just wanted to say I'm totally with you. But since you were talking about the Cubs,
the
play of last night was after Javi tagged out Puig and was shaking his finger at him, I just burst out laughing. I was fit to be tied, but when I saw that, I'm like, okay, at least there's some grain of dignity left with the team that they're not going to let him steamroll them all over him.
Yeah, a little moxie still, yeah. And if anybody would have it would be Baez.
And
you did want to kick the dust in anybody's face, it would be Puig, too. I mean, good grief.
Yeah, after he pointed out the center field and what was that, game one or two?
Yeah, right.
I thought at that point somebody should have thrown at that guy the very next time he came up to hit with with that kind of gumption.
Yeah, no kidding. I'm feeling your pain, my friend, and I appreciate your phone call.
Sure, no problem. But let me just say, I'm with you with the whole Trump thing. There's so much craziness going on, and the amount of time spent on that, I don't even watch the news anymore because it's just more of the same. It's like you already know the outcome of a game. It's like every time something comes up, you know where it's going. And so it's just like I don't want to have to hear any more of it. You know, it's just mind-numbing.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call. I'm glad you said that. It's a challenge for those of us that do these radio shows to know how much of it to talk about, for that matter, because all of us need a break, and yet it's the President of the United States acting unhinged. So how can you not pay attention to that? It's a real tough one. I appreciate your phone call. I'll tell you what, it was startling last night. It wasn't the president. It wasn't even the Cubs game. Did you see Gordon Hayward fall in the Boston Celtics-Cleveland Cavaliers game?
I saw the still, and I couldn't even watch the video.
It's one of the most violent injuries you'll ever see in sport. It's one of those instances where the guy goes up, comes down, his leg does something that legs cannot do. And what's the most telling part of that is, I don't want you to look at the pictures or watch the video if you don't want to, but a lot of the pictures that are posted show Gordon Hayward of the Boston Celtics, the $100 million man who's going to lead them to the promised land, right? And there he is 5 minutes into the new season with a career, or at least with a season-ending injury. And what you see is the faces of the people in the first few rows of the crowd. The people with the good seats that are right there on the floor, they are horrified. Their expressions are so telling.
And I saw stills of the players, too, like, I mean, in a walking communal, away, or in
yeah.
a communal embrace,
oh, yeah,
like
yeah,
trying
yeah.
to deal with it.
Well, God bless the Cleveland Cavaliers. LeBron James was there consoling him. You know, I mean, this is a young man in life-threatening kind of pain. And it's not about basketball then, you know. It's just about that kid suffering. So that's too bad. It's 1:31. We'll pause here. Steve's going to do the news. Afterwards, Thomas Jefferson, third president of the United States, lightens things up on WGN. Thank you, Steve. A Halloween tradition on the John Williams Show. We like to play a song from a group called The Shags. The Shags, an all-girl group from Indiana in the 60s. This monster hit is called It's Halloween. Let's take a listen. Why even Dracula will be there. It's 1:42, and that's The Shags. I know you enjoyed it, and don't worry, there's plenty more of that to come over the next 14 days, 2 weeks starting today here on The John Williams Show. The Shags, It's Halloween. Thomas Jefferson is the third president of these United States. He joins us now on WGN Radio. President Jefferson, welcome to the show.
Good day to you, citizen.
Did you celebrate Halloween? Were you a big trick-or-treat guy?
You know, such a thing did not exist in my time. The closest we had was on the Christmas holidays, and on Boxing Day, on the day after Christmas, there was sort of a reversal where the servants played the masters, and the masters gave food and gifts and waited on the lower classes, and tricks were played, and the kind of trick or treat tradition existed then, but not on All Hallowed Eve.
Oh, yeah. It's too bad. It's kind of fun. Everybody goes for candy these days. It's a really big holiday in America, maybe like our second most, in terms of dollars spent, holiday in the United States, bigger than the 4th of July, Independence Day, Thanksgiving. It's Christmas and Halloween, man.
I wouldn't want to be a killjoy, but I would have been very skeptical of any event, even a secular event, that's based on a saint's day. You know, the Catholic tradition going back to the early Middle Ages celebrated the putative birth dates of saints, and the Protestant Reformation swept all that away, and the Enlightenment looked upon it with a sort of fairy tale sadness.
Yeah, you're way overthinking it. It's mostly just about candy and dressing up and going to parties. Like, what would your favorite candy be? If you were handing out candy, if I came up to Monticello and it's like, oh, this is the Jeffersons. Whew, that was a hike. But here we are, and we open up the door. What would you be handing out?
We might have had a bit of licorice. You know, we really would have probably served baked goods, and I doubt that that would be very acceptable in your time.
That is a loser house. You know, the kids walk all the way up the hill, then you're handing out some muffins or something. That is not getting it done. They want the big candy bars.
If they came to Monticello, I would invite them in and show them my entry hall with artifacts from the Lewis and Clark expedition and some previously unpublished maps of Central and South America and some bones from the mastodon and the woolly mammoth, and they might find that just fascinating.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore. People would look skeptically on your motives or intentions, I think, if you invited the children in and said, hey, let's go to the map room. That doesn't
They might be
well.
Fascinated by my calendar clock. You know, I had a clock that not only told the time of the day, but the day of the week. It had some weights, and those weights resembled sort of a cantaloupe or a cannonball, and they would move down along the wall on a chain. And on the wall, I had placards pasted that said Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and so on. I think all children of any time or place would be fascinated by that.
Somebody just sent us a text. Again, President Jefferson's on the phone. We asked him to join us today just to remind you that you and I will be on stage at the Elgin Community College December 2nd, and that tickets to our conversation are available at WGNradio.com/events right now. A texter
what
just,
do you want to talk about?
Well, so much that I almost even don't want to address it here. We're going to talk on stage soon enough. I will tease you at least with some of the topics I will address. But this texter writes, ask Mr. Jefferson what he thought of his portrayal in the play Hamilton. Have you seen Hamilton on stage yet, sir?
Sir, I have not, but I'm aware of it, and I understand that they have aggrandized Colonel Hamilton, who was born in obscurity in the Caribbean and was a man who wanted a hereditary monarchy for the United States and never saw a war that he didn't like. And they have done that by denigrating me and making me appear to be a duplicitous Machiavellian figure. So I have to say I regret that sort of a portrayal. Hamilton would have been a great prime minister of England, but he was a very poor American in my view.
We're trying to figure out who the right Americans are to honor with statues. Every now and then we go through this, but, should we have one of Christopher Columbus? Should we have one of Balbo? It turns out that this Italian Balbo was maybe not a person who had America's best interest at heart, and yet in Chicago we have a street named after him, and for that matter we have statues of him, to say nothing of the problem of Confederate statues in the United States. What would the Founding Fathers say about honoring these people that way?
Well, we saw things a little bit differently. We still had a great deal of respect for Columbus because he inadvertently happened upon the New World and set in motion a set of historical dynamics of really extraordinary human importance, not just for the people of the emerging United States, but for all of the peoples of the world. We did not judge quite as severely as I think you are now judging, and I wonder if it's a very good idea. If you continue down this path of removing every American figure who you can find objectionable from a 21st century sense of righteousness, I doubt that my statues will be able to survive that movement, and maybe Monticello will be plucked down too.
Well, that's what they say. What about Jefferson? What about Washington? And so on and so forth. Here's another question that's resonating in current times. I don't know if you have anything to say about it today. You might think about this for our December 2nd conversation. You didn't happen to call the families of the men who died in the Revolutionary War and offer your condolences, did you?
No, we had no telephones, but I did write to the families of some of the fallen when I was serving as the governor of Virginia. I wouldn't have presumed to do so in any other situation. And while I was president, I was able for 8 years to preside over peace and prosperity with very little death and destruction anywhere in the new world. But I do think that we have a special duty. You know, the gravest thing that a president can ever do without any question is to send your children, your sons, into harm's way. And if those children go at the behest of the president, that's a tremendously dramatic responsibility for that person. And if that child or miscarries, if he dies, if he's killed in war, if he's captured, the president bears some responsibility for that, because the president is the only figure in our culture who is elected by all of the Americans, and he's the only one who can send troops into harm's way. So I think that the president has an enormous moral responsibility to keep the peace. And if he can't keep the peace for whatever reason and is forced to enter a war, he must do so with the deepest sense of somberness and misgiving. And he must then make sure that he pays the fullest possible respect to anyone who dies under his watch.
Thomas Jefferson's on the phone. How often do you get to say that? We'll pause here. By the way, my number is 312-981-7200 if you want to text or call in with a question. I'll ask this, and we'll get the answer on the other side, if you don't mind, Mr. President. And that is, you guys did not anticipate the 25th Amendment, I don't think. I wonder what you think about it as it is today. We're talking to President Thomas Jefferson. He and I will be on stage, as we often do. On December 2nd, we'll be at Elgin's Community College. If you want tickets to see President Jefferson on stage, and you really will enjoy and benefit from this, go to WGNradio.com/events right now before, and we're only doing one show with President Jefferson, so act now before the show sells out. What would you make of the 25th Amendment, mental incompetence? Should we execute that, or what do you think of that?
You know, there were only a dozen amendments in the course of my time, and the bulk of those were the Bill of Rights, which was, in a sense, a second constitution. So the Constitution had not been amended very much at the time of my death in 1826. We did have some difficulties with this issue, but we wouldn't have known how to handle it. Of course, the government wasn't as important in my time as it is in yours, and there wasn't so much a sense of urgency. But George Washington, how shall I put this carefully? He's a man I revere, but by the time he left office, he had lost some of his mental acuity, and that made him, I suppose you would say Alzheimer's today, but I that term did not exist in my time. But we worried about his mental preparedness in the last year or so of his second term. And John Adams was so erratic, so odd, so irascible, volatile, unable to maintain a kind of steadiness of purpose, that even people of his own party worried that he was perhaps going insane. Turns out it was just his character. It's just the way John Adams was. But I must say that this is a very, I think, a dangerous doctrine in that amendment, because the president is elected by the people, and the people have decided. And I think it takes a very extraordinary crisis for anyone to void an election.
That's interesting. So you say, unless they really go off the deep end, just being extremely unpopular should not be sufficient reason to throw them out, huh?
That certainly should not be a reason to throw someone out. But even if someone is not at his mental best, that does not necessarily mean that you eliminate him from the presidency. I think that is a very dangerous doctrine in the Republic. It could be misused for partisan purposes. Factions could attempt to characterize the president as erratic. And remember, in our system, we have three branches. They check and balance each other. That's why our system is so strong. And the legislative branch in a republic is meant to be the most important of the three branches. And so in some sense, the president is much less important to the sanctity and the stability of the country than the legislature.
Ron on line one wants to know what you think of John Brown, and this texter wants to know what you think of mental health. They understand that you were maybe clinically depressed at times. What should we do about mental health in this country? I don't have time for either of those. We're out of time now, President Jefferson, but this is kind of the line I'll take you on, maybe when we get on stage in December.
I was never depressed, but I did have times of grief, and the best answer is hard exercise and mental work.
Well, nobody was better at that than you, so bring your best game for us, sir, on December 2nd at the, not College of DuPage now, we're going to be in Elgin. It's a lovely little town. They got a terrific community college and a nice stage there. You and I will be on stage December 2nd, okay?
I so look forward to seeing you again, sir.
That's the third president of your United States. Please go to WGNradio.com/events. All the details and ticket information are there.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Well,
here's John Williams.
I'm going to borrow one. It's 208. Thanks again to President Jefferson for joining us in the last half hour. And again, how often do you get a chance to hear that? TJ and I on stage in Elgin at the Blizzard Theater. Makes it sound like we're going to work the lobby of a Dairy Queen, but it's the name of the theater. I don't know why they call it that. It's at Elgin Community College, and we'll be on stage, and we expect another sold-out show, particularly since we're doing just one TJ show. And then there's another conversation we'll have on stage when we clear that theater out and run them all back in again for Meriwether Lewis. These are really extraordinary opportunities, and what are you doing on December 2nd, right? You're just kind of rolling around after Thanksgiving. It's too soon to really be wrapped up in all your Christmas parties. December 2nd, spend a little time with us late in the morning or early in the afternoon. Tickets are at WGNradio.com/events. Mayim Bialik in the New York Times wrote an op-ed piece, Being a Feminist in Harvey Weinstein's World. And boy, did she create a kerfuffle. You remember her as Blossom Russo in Blossom. She's also, of course, part of the Big Bang Theory, where she has the role of Amy. She reminds us that's the number one sitcom in America. She said that as an 11-year-old kid who broke into acting on Blossom, quote, I did not look or act like other girls in my industry, and that I was immersing myself in a business that rewarded physical beauty and sex appeal above all else. Later, she says that a TV Guide critic described her as, in a review of a plot episode of Blossom, as having, quote, a shield-shaped face of mismatched features. I never recovered from seeing myself that way, she wrote. She said, I eventually left the business when I was 19 to pursue a doctorate in neuroscience at the University of California. I craved being around people who valued me more for what was inside my brain than inside my bra. After 12 years away from Hollywood, I returned to acting, largely because I had no health insurance and missed performing and making people laugh. As a non-traditional looking woman, I came back to an industry that had me auditioning for the frumpy friend or the Zaftig secretary. She said, as a proud feminist with little desire to diet, get plastic surgery, or hire a personal trainer, I have almost no personal experience with men asking me to meetings in their hotel rooms. Those of us in Hollywood who don't represent an impossible standard of beauty have the luxury, she put that in quotes, of being overlooked and in many cases ignored by men in power. Unless we can make them money. I still make choices every day as a 41-year-old actress that I think of as self-protecting and wise. I have decided that my sexual self is best reserved for private situations with those I am most intimate with. I dress modestly. I don't act flirtatiously with men as a policy. In a perfect world, women should be free to act however they want, but we can't be naive about the culture. If, like me, you're not a perfect 10, know that there are people out there who will find you stunning, irresistible, and worthy of attention, respect, and love. The best part is that you do not have to go to a hotel room or a casting couch to find them, said Mayim Bialik, the star one time of Blossom and now of Big Bang Theory. So guess who wrote about that? Heidi Stevens did a hashtag MeToo piece, and she's in our studio right now to talk a little bit about it. Hi, Heidi. Thanks for coming in again.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
You read that piece, too. What was your first reaction?
I thought it was tone deaf. I thought it was conflating two very real problems, but not the same. The problem she's talking about is not the same problem as women being harassed and assaulted by predators in their industry. We're talking about Hollywood in this case, but she's talking about, you know, a sort of toxic emphasis on women's appearance. That's not the same problem as women being harassed and insulted when they're trying to do their jobs.
Well, let's talk about her first point, though. Do you at least buy into that you can be rewarded for your talents and your person, not your sexuality or your appearance, if you choose to? I mean, I do hear her saying that, don't you? I dress conservatively. She said you can find people who will reward you for who you are, not how you look.
Sure. I don't think the women who are accusing Harvey Weinstein of harassment and rape are feeling like he didn't reward them enough. I think they're saying that he harassed and raped them. So I just think she's talking about the wrong
That's
problem.
Interesting. There was no quid pro quo there. I mean, they weren't saying, okay, let's make a deal. And shame on these people that are willing to do that dance with the devil. They didn't ask to go to the dance,
no,
did they?
No, they were auditioning. They were going to business meetings. They were doing their job. And now they're alleging that in the course of that job they were trying to do, they were being harassed and in some cases raped. So it doesn't matter what they were wearing. We have no indication that they were flirting. This isn't a situation where he's saying, well, I guess I misread the cues.
Right.
No, they were walking in to talk to you about work, and then you asked them to, you know, watch you shower.
Watch you shower, and then he comes out with the bathrobe. He had an MO, didn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. And what she's implying is that women can avoid these things if they're deliberate enough. And I don't think that's the case. I certainly don't think that sounds like it was the case with Harvey Weinstein.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So then you said you were going to challenge her piece. And then you said, wait, the internet kind of did it.
Yeah, it kind of beat me to it.
A zillion people went, oh, huh. And then this hashtag MeToo emerged. Talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. So her piece went online, I think, on a Friday. And then over the weekend, Alyssa Milano shared, you know, this tweet that ended up going viral. She didn't write it. She shared it, though. And it said, you know, something to the effect of, if every woman who's experienced harassment or assault put the words Me Too on their timeline, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, it might help people get an idea of the scope of this problem. And women and men started to do just that immediately, right? Me Too, Me Too, Me Too. By Monday morning, Alyssa Milano's tweet alone had 40,000 replies. My timelines on all my social media feeds were filled with, you know, guys and women saying Me Too, and in some cases attaching a story to it, and in some cases not. And they were a very quick and true rebuttal of what Mayim was saying in her op-ed, which I read her op-ed to say, if you do these things, you, like me, will avoid being harassed or assaulted. And a lot of these stories that were attached to the Me Too proved very quickly that it does not matter if you take the steps that she has taken. You could still be harassed or assaulted. People were sharing stories about being raped as children. A woman that I'm friends with talked about being raped by the owner of the restaurant where she waitressed while she was in seminary. I mean, these aren't situations where it's like, well, you know, it's a little gray area. These are black and white, heartbreaking stories that thousands upon thousands of men and women have.
And have been carrying around secretly for a lot.
A lot.
For many of them. And there are, though, the stories that are, some of them are sexual assault, some of them are not. Some of them are just gross, boorish behavior that nobody should have to tolerate. And there was no recourse 5 years ago or 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of those are kind of falling under the hashtag Me Too, aren't they?
Yeah. That's definitely the impression I get as well. You know, in the original message was harassment or assault, and those are different things. And as you say, nobody should be exposed to either one, but they are different things. And so some people are saying, you know, I never even considered this really to be all that bad, but yes, I have worked in situations where X, Y, and Z happen. And
how do you explain, or what do you say about the silence, though, that has been around Harvey Weinstein all along?
Yeah, I think that.
How was he able to get away with it for so long?
Well, it was written into his contract. I mean, that came out that he would be able to pay off, you know, pay settlements to women for these kinds of accusations and continue in the job he had.
Pardon me, I knew that he was doing that, but what do you mean it was in his contract?
It was in a contract. There was a story about this a couple of days ago that came out that was written into his contract, that whatever number of settlements he pays out, that is not allowed to, you know, take him down out of his position.
His company, the board signed that deal with him.
That's right.
That's unconscionable. That's amazing.
I agree.
You needed me to tell you that, didn't you? But I mean, here again, I did not know that was an option. I didn't know that existed.
I know. I guess if you run the company, it's easier to get that clause. You know, I think that I was just talking about this at lunch with, you know, a group of people. Why is Harvey Weinstein on the cover of Time with the headline Producer, Predator, Pariah this quickly when we have seen Bill Cosby, Donald Trump, Bill Clinton,
Roger Ailes,
Anthony Weiner? I mean, man after man have similar accusations bounce off of them.
Well, all of those people suffered the price, paid the price.
How do you mean?
Well, Cosby's life's over, career is over. Wiener's out of a job and out of a marriage.
Cosby's accusers are saying that this stuff was happening in the 70s. I mean, he wasn't really out of a job.
Not at the time.
Right.
I'm sorry. Your point is that Weinstein's going down so quickly.
That's my point. Yeah. That's my point. People immediately believed these women and immediately took action to get this guy out of the situations that he was placing himself in to be able to do the alleged serial predating. Now, is that because the women's names are Ashley Judd, Gwyneth Paltrow, Angelina Jolie? I think it probably is.
You know, and what I asked you, which got you going in that vein, was, so I wonder why they waited so long. Did they not know one amongst the other that they were all going through it and that collectively they could bring this guy down rather than the other way around?
I don't know that they did wait so long. I mean, certainly the Ronan Farrow's piece in The New Yorker relied on the New York sting operation, you know, that happened years ago. I think women were saying for a long time, this is happening to me. I don't think people were listening for a long time. I don't think this was a situation where, I mean, some of the women are saying, okay, yeah, now that we're talking about this, yeah, me too. This was not a case where the women were all silent up until last Thursday. This is a case where no one was listening until last Thursday.
I wonder, too, if it's not just Harvey Weinstein. I mean, he's maybe the most notable, maybe the most powerful figure in Hollywood, but there's probably a second most powerful guy in Hollywood. I wonder if he's a cad as well.
Well, yeah, the Amazon guy who just stepped down, right?
Right. Or Weinstein's brother, for that matter.
Weinstein's brother, Bob.
And then, you know, obviously the tech sector appears to be rife with sexism, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Broadcasting's not immune to it. I suppose publishing is the same way. I just wonder how endemic it is.
I wonder that, too. And I think that's the thing that the Me Too campaign makes me feel hopeful about, is that those are some of the kinds of questions that we are going to start asking. And, you know, I think probably any industry in which women have sort of been the other, you know, they're sort of not necessarily running things. They're sort of not in a lot of the meetings. When they are there, it's a little bit of an oddity, like, oh, hey. Instead of just, okay, Susan, what's the P&L today? You know what I mean? I think that, you know, a lot of workplaces have been that way for a long time, and they're getting less so, but it takes a while. And so I think we're asking the kinds of questions now that we should have probably been asking a while.
I have to pause. I noticed at the end of your piece, you said Me Too,
mm-hmm.
and then you didn't elaborate. Do you want to?
Not that much. I elaborated a little bit more in a piece I wrote last week. It was, you know, I worked in a place where I was the only woman, and it was men who were a lot older than I was at the time. I was in my early 20s. They were a pretty vulgar group, I would say, and so I quickly figured out I should dress I guess modestly. You know, it was a super casual environment, so I'd show up in sweatshirts and jeans. And I wrote this right after Donna Karan
Oh, yeah, that was amazing. So, yeah. That was amazing.
Said some, maybe some women are asking for it. She said the words asking for it with how they dress.
And then later said that was taken out of context. And I thought, well, what context? It seemed pretty clear what you meant by that.
Yeah, and I watched the video and it really wasn't taken out of context. But
really
anyway,
it wasn't.
It really wasn't at all.
You're so right about that. Hold on a second. Wait, stay right there. Okay. Do you mind? Do you have another minute?
Yeah, I do.
We're concluding a conversation with Heidi Stevens, balancing act in the Chicago Tribune. She wrote about the hashtag MeToo movement and really based it in part, at least she started by commenting on what Mayim Bialik wrote in the New York Times, being a feminist in Harvey Weinstein's world. Somebody just texted, and a couple calls have said this too. Do you have the text in front of you?
Yeah, I do. Here you go.
Let me read this thing. It says, hey, I think Mayim Bialik was simply stating that Hollywood only acknowledges beauty. I don't get out of what she said that dressing down like she does makes her immune to harassment. She's not saying actor dress like me keeps you out of trouble. I'm not sure what was all of that about, but I think she's commenting on, I'm not sure what she's commenting on.
Well, I think Mayim said just that, the dressing like me keeps you out of trouble. I mean, she talked about how she doesn't act flirtatiously. She keeps her sexual self to herself and she dresses modestly.
It's funny coming from a woman. It's like the Donna Karan point you were making a moment ago. That does sound like victim blaming or shaming, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Yeah, and that was the only reason I brought up the sweatshirts or, you know, what I used to wear to this job is just to say that showing up at work in a sweatshirt and baggy jeans simply changed the words that the guys around me chose to use. So it was more, you know, don't you have any tight little skirts and what's on under that sweatshirt and stuff like that. So to tell a woman that if she just wouldn't dress that way, she wouldn't be harassed is so disingenuous and so naive, willfully naive, I would say, as to really be not just not useful in this conversation, but really counterproductive.
Does it shock you that, I mean, I wonder, what is it with these guys? I mean, really, so you became successful. Were you that way all along? And then when you get to the top, you just think rules don't apply. It's like Donald Trump. When you're famous, when you're a star, you get away with it. And even if it feels like that's possible, what is it with these guys that were raised in a way that they would then take advantage of that if that's how they perceive it to be at the top?
I can't figure that out. I don't know. I got an email from a guy this morning who didn't like my column, and he said, you know, explain to me why women try to make themselves attractive in the first place then, which is really interesting that someone would have that question. And I wrote him back, and I don't always, but, you know, he didn't call me any names or anyway, I wrote him back and I said, I mean, for the same reason that men try to make themselves attractive. I mean, women aren't standing up and saying, I don't want any dates. I don't want a partner. I don't want any love interest in my life. I want to be left alone. We just want to be left alone by the Harvey Weinsteins. I mean, do you want to watch Harvey Weinstein shower?
No, I don't.
So you're not saying I never want anyone to find me attractive. I don't want love. I would hate to go on a date. You want to pick and choose who touches you, right? And makes comments to you. And why is that such a foreign concept? Men go through life with that comfort level, knowing that people aren't going to come up and grab their junk if they don't want to. So women should be afforded that same respect and also be allowed to make themselves attractive without that seeming like some kind of
contradiction.
Right?
Oh, then why did you wear the skirt?
Then why? Yeah, why are you pretty?
Heidi Stevens's balancing act is in today's Chicago Tribune. Nice to see you again, Heidi. Thanks for saying hi.
Thanks for having me.
This is a show about a scrawny guy named Joel Stein. In real life, he writes for a magazine called Time. But now he's got his own...
Joel Stein, the columnist who writes the awesome column weekly for Time magazine. I think it's weekly. We'll clear that up in just a minute. Joins us regularly on the show. He's always kind enough to take our call and talk to us about some of the things he's writing about.
Sometimes he gets punched out. Joel never learns. Hey, Joel, what do you know? You got your... show, try not to blow it,
Show.
In a recent edition, he wrote, "What I Learned About Leadership from Leading Leaders." Hi, Joel Stein. Welcome to the show again.
Oh, thank you for having me and playing my theme song.
I'm not sure if you and I are best friends now because are you a Dodgers fan?
Well, it's worse than that. I am a Yankees fan.
Oh.
So I do like the Dodgers, though.
Sure.
I guess I am rooting for them, although, of course, I like the Cubs, like any human being.
Take a stand, Joel.
Come on, Joel. Be a leader.
I'm a Yankees fan.
Okay. All right. Was that so difficult? You didn't need to patch everybody up.
You're right. I'm running for office now. It's all very touchy.
You know, actually, everything is don't you hate that if you order French fries, people go, well, you know what Donald Trump said about French fries? Don't you hate
freedom
that?
Fries. What are you talking about, French fries?
Don't you hate that everything at least can go through the president and how that sort of pollutes some of the simplest conversations? Don't you hate that, Joel?
Especially this one. It came out of nowhere. I don't know where you got that from.
I don't know. It made me think of the thing, and I'm not going to connect those dots. Let's read from your column, shall we?
That's much better.
It says here, I get deeply insulted when people say, lead, follow, or get out of the way. My entire career, you wrote, has consisted of getting in the way. It's why people don't like journalists. We're always getting in the way of leaders by nitpicking that they shouldn't start a war with North Korea. You also wrote, actually, people don't like journalists because we're smug and nerdy, which is the same thing as getting in the way. And then you went on to say, okay, if I am going to write about leadership, I'm going to reach out to a couple of experts in the field. And you turned to one guy named Jocko Willink, who wrote a book about his time as a Navy SEAL and why the SEALs always win. What on earth inspired you really to go down this road, Joel? Why were you thinking about leadership?
You know, I didn't have space to put it in, but there were a bunch of articles lately, namely one that I really liked in Harvard Magazine about how colleges should stop asking students, you know, prospective students, applicants, to be leaders. That there's, you know, there are artists, there are all kinds of other people that are useful in society. We don't all have to be leaders. Like, everyone's trying to be a leader now. We teach that to our children. Enough with that.
Yeah.
Enough leaders.
I think that's right. What's wrong with being a really good follower? We need those too, right?
We need followers. We need get in the wayers. We need a vast consortium of people. And if everyone's trying to be a leader, it's just a mess.
But you know, is this your observation too? It is kind of shocking to me how bad people in leadership positions are at that too. I don't know if it's that way in print, but Lord, in broadcasting, there are people in management positions who should not be there.
Yeah, it's hard, and I don't know why we list that. Like, I think it's part of the narcissistic culture that we feel like everyone has to be a leader. Like, you can excel in lots of things without having a bunch of people follow you.
And I'm not sure
why we teach that to our children.
Well, and I'm not sure that it's leadership that's my problem. I don't think you can be a good leader if you're just not smart and empathetic and competent with human beings. I don't know if that's what leaders are supposed to be or not, but, you know, too many people in too many positions of authority just don't have those skills or attributes.
Yeah, and then people think they should be leaders without doing the requisite work of being somewhat self-aware and listening. And, okay, I'm working myself up here.
Well, so here's what you also wrote. You said, I learned that there are tricks that could improve my leadership, like being named Jocko Willink.
Yeah, that would help.
Instead of Joel Stein. You do have kind of a wimpy name, you know, now that you mention it.
You know, I once taught a class, and one of my students' dad wrote Risky Business, and I said, can you just ask him one question? Why did he name the main character Joel? Right?
And sure.
So I asked him, and the answer was, because it's the wimpiest name he could think of. Nerdiest, wimpiest name he could think of.
That's kind of an albatross around your neck now, isn't it, my friend?
My parents saddled me with.
Willink suggested that I needed to work on my leadership voice just like I honed my writing voice. And that voice needed to be much louder, more confident, and concise while delivering simpler ideas. You write that as though that's kind of silly or sarcastic, but I actually think that's a good
idea.
That is a good point, isn't it?
And he meant literally your voice should be louder. that was a key component of people who were able to lead.
So go ahead and do a little leadership. Like, give me Joel, the new reformed leader.
Ask shorter questions.
Joel, do I have to be the leader voice too, or I'll just ask simpler questions?
No, we don't all have to be leaders. That's
right.
Yeah. You lost the point already.
John C. Maxwell, you said, has sold a million copies each.
Do you know this guy?
No. I do not read this stuff.
No, but if you were to read this stuff, he is, you know, Tony Robbins. He's huge. He's been around forever.
Really? John Maxwell? And does that, it must work, huh? People must read that and go, hey, Bob, we should do more of this loud, short sentence stuff, huh?
Yeah, well, that's Jocko Willink. This guy has a slightly different attitude towards leadership.
What's that?
It was a lot about listening and just influence, just having a clear kind of philosophy and using it to influence people.
Yeah, sure. And yet, you know, I'm reading this and I'm thinking about them reading this. So I'm reading your column and I'm thinking,
my dad said the same thing to me.
What do Jocko Willink and John C. Maxwell think after being kind of skewered by you? There they were giving honest, sincere advice to you, and then you just kind of turning it on its head.
Well, I didn't see it that way, but you and my dad did see it that way. And the short answer is my guess.
I want a short, loud answer, Joel.
They're too busy to read my column. So I haven't heard from them.
Yeah. If they ever get around to it, because they're probably leading people, you know, doing stuff. Yeah.
Oh, for sure.
But I think you were kind of making fun of them in this.
I didn't mean to. I really liked them both.
You can't help yourself, can you? It's like, that's just the way you are wired, Joel Stein.
I don't see it that way. I see it, when people do it to me, I may not see it as mean. I see it as kind of entertaining, or that they see some part of me that makes me feel seen. I got problems.
Well, I think at the end of the day, and maybe this is something all good leaders have to have too, I think you have a strong enough sense of self that if people are laughing at or mocking you a little bit, you can take it. And I think a good leader has to have that as well.
Yeah, it comes just from doing this for a long time. You develop crocodile skin and you realize that other people's anger isn't necessarily about you all the time.
Anything else you're working on these days, Joel Stein? What's your next column or book or project about?
Well, I'm writing that book on defending elitism, but I, after 19 years of writing a column, time is finally getting rid of me at the end of the year.
I didn't know that. I'm sorry to hear that.
No, I haven't told anyone. You're the first. I mean, I've told my parents, my wife, but you're the only one I've told on the radio.
It's funny because I just talked to Heidi Stevens, who writes for the Chicago Tribune, and every columnist that I talk to, everybody knows Joel Stein. They all love you. They love your work. I think it's important that, you know, your peers appreciate you, but I think average Americans do too. Why in the world does Time not want you to do an awesome column anymore?
Probably because you're not running Time. But, I think they figured that 19 years was a good run.
Well, that's true. That's true. So what are you going to do with your extra time?
I'm going to try and find a job, I think.
Yeah, I'm telling you, Joel, you and I have had this conversation off the air, but since we're just being honest on the air, you should be a radio talk show host.
I would love it. That sounds fun. It doesn't sound, I don't know how to say this in a nice way. It sounds like a skill I would like to develop, and it's certainly a skill, but it does sound easier.
If I can speak for Joel, John, he's saying anyone can do it.
I know exactly what he's saying. It's 2:52. We'll give Joel a couple of tips in a minute. We're talking to our friend Joel Stein, whose recent awesome column in Time Magazine, What I Learned About Leadership from Leading Leaders, is, as always, very good, very funny, very thoughtful, and makes fun of the people that he interviewed. Joel just shared with us that this is going to be his last year at Time Magazine. They're not going to renew his contract with them after, well, a couple of months here, in part because of the non-dynamic picture they put in his column each week. Joel, did you think that picture was helping you over the 19-year run?
No, that picture always drove me crazy. I don't think you should see columnists. I think it ruins whatever image you have of them. At best, I thought you should have a cartoon, and I did pose for that picture with a huge frown, which I thought was really funny because no one does that for their photos, and they didn't put that.
Yeah, all of that's lost on me, but I completely agree with what you say. I think that too often columns pictures don't do the columnist justice. I like the idea of a self-portrait. That's a little expressive. Or not at all. I completely agree with you on that. Joel, maybe one of your columns will be about, you know, new career opportunities for you, new directions to go.
You know what? I have two left. For the last one, I'm interviewing, I've interviewed like Larry David and Vince Gilligan about what the best kind of a last finale episode would be.
Oh, good. Yeah, I get it. Sure.
Yep. Yeah. For my next to last one, though, maybe I should do some career hunting. That seems smart.
Yeah. Well, feel free to interview me if you want. But
tell me about radio jobs.
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you how your skills translate and what you would need to work on and what the earning. What did you get paid for that column in Time Magazine?
I get paid $2 million a year. Is that commensurate with radio jobs?
You do get $2 million, but...
No. I'm just kidding.
Not per year.
Time will be mad, but who cares? They're going to fire me anyway because they never want other people to know. But I was getting $3,600 a column.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds low. That sounds low to me.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. For you? Joel Stein? Time Magazine?
They're getting rid of me. They can't afford it. But it's part of it.
Well, good luck to you, Joel. Listen, everybody read his piece. Continue to read him. Continue to follow him. And look for the column he's going to do where he interviews me before the end of the year.
Yeah, it'll be real soon.
All right. Thanks, Joel. It's Rokan and it's Anna DeVlantis.
Yes.
Hi, kids.
Mm-hmm.
Hello.
Hi.
John.
I'm sorry I took more of your time than I'm supposed to, but I felt bad. I didn't know that Joel's last column was right around the corner, and he's going to have to find new work. And I'm a big fan of his. So
and Time is going to cut back on, did I read this right? That Time is going to cut back a number of issues a year. And Sports Illustrated is going to do the same thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, some magazines, famous good ones, don't publish every week. And he said it was a cost-cutting thing. They didn't want to pay him the money anymore.
Right.
Do you think Time Magazine, because they got $3,700 a week, pay Joel Stein? I don't know. That didn't sound... I thought he would get $1 million a year to do that. I don't know what they paid. Famous.
It seems high. But
I think in the print world. I just started getting... It's funny. I did one of those things where I... You know, with my miles were expiring, mm-hmm. And I only had...
You fell for that one?
I'm a United guy, so I went with the American, so I went with the I get now, like, 12 magazines a day.
That's good.
You know, and
we
it's like...
support journalism.
Right, and I thought, well, that's good, and mm-hmm. I don't, you know, I'm not really paying for it, and I get all this stuff, and I stack them, and they make really interesting stacks of things, and I'm like, I never, ever open them up, because I'm reading everything on my phone. What am I doing?
Just be careful on the recurring backside of that, because you have to make sure you want to read up on all of them.
Yeah,
you can find yourself a
lifetime of these things. Mm-hmm. I always leave my New Yorker just laying out casually, like, oh, that thing.
So smart.
Did you notice that? It's right there. Here's my New Yorker.
Yeah, I know. I do that with New York. That's like whether you're Mets or Yankees, it's like, are you a New York or New Yorker? Are you, you know, Cubs or Sox? But you know, that's the way that I'm
you're
like,
New York, huh?
I'm New York, yeah.
Boy, I think that's nose in the air to my nose in the air.
Yeah, I do the opposite. I have Us Weekly, and when people come over, I hide it. I just like, no, it's not mine. No, a friend dropped it off. I love that magazine.
I also get People, and I've noticed that People's not interesting anymore.
I've noticed that too. Just recently went through a People and I went, when did you guys quit?
Yeah, they
this
quit being
terrible.
They, right. It's Us Weekly or US Weekly, as they call it, because it's a big, important national periodical.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
That's at least, you know, it's got pictures and it's got a little snark to it.
Yes.
People is always about, her comeback from alcoholism. I don't care.
It's so funny.
Well, it always seems like, they're produced by their publicists.
Yes,
all those articles.
That's it.
Whereas
it's also
or
positive.
US is totally real. It feels a little more like
caught. They're going after people.
Or like,
busted.
Look, celebrities just like us, they pay parking tickets and shop at grocery stores too. And I'm like, oh yeah, see? There you go.
Have a good show, you guys.